On today's Compassion Radio.
This notion that we should all think the same and act the same, to me, sounds like people who want to live in North Korea. I don't want to be in a community of people who dress alike, look alike, think alike, act alike. I love the variety that comes with embracing the other.
Hi, friends, and welcome back to day three of a special series on Compassion Radio that we're calling Road to Compassion. It seems often that the roads we're compelled to travel were not chosen by us. Does that mean we're compelled to make certain decisions, too? Or do we have real freedom to choose no matter what the circumstances? You might want to hold judgment on that for a minute. When Jesus tells us that greater love has no man than this, that he laid down his life for his friends, he's really talking about himself. He knew what his mission was and was willingly choosing to follow through in the way his Father showed him. You could reasonably say that he really had no choice, but not because he couldn't choose. Rather, I believe, it was because he knew exactly who he was and what he was about. So, when we face decisions that will cost us something, it doesn't have to mean that we're conflicted, but maybe that we're presented with an opportunity to really count the cost. Karen Zacharias certainly faced that challenge and learned that the way of discipleship really does have a cost, has consequences, but more importantly, has rich rewards. Today we finish our conversation on how the choice to live a life of faith required a radical rethink on what compassion really means, and how God would weave together her history of loss and loneliness in order to bring the compassion of Christ to others. We'll pick it up today with a recap from yesterday's program.
It reminds me a bit of Texas history, our own legends here, about the Alamo. William Travis, as a commander, he took his sword and drew a line in the sand and said, "Who will stand with me and fight?" They had to make a decision about who they were going to be in the next few hours. The reason they were there defending the Alamo was not just for territory, it was to defend women and children who were going to be carted off into human trafficking. It wasn't a declaration of war, it was a declaration of suicide, of being willing to die to self. Is that the kind of themes that you have some of your characters deal with in your novels?
Certainly the notion of laying down a man's life has been prevalent throughout my life because of my father's death in Vietnam. Mm. Because of his death, I traveled to Vietnam back in 2004, where my father died. While I was on that journey, I encountered a young man whose father also died in Vietnam, fighting with the South Vietnamese against the Arvin. I sat and listened to Peter's story throughout the time that we spent together. He was the youngest of eight kids, and following his father's death in Vietnam, his father's body was never returned to the family. They were never allowed to put up pictures of his father in the home because they were only to honor Ho Chi Minh. You know, we have continued to be friends, but the point of all of this is to say, for so many years, I'd spent time thinking about how that war had impacted our family or our nation. And I had never given any thought to the children on the other side or the impact on that country.
Yeah.
Prior to the trip, I saw Vietnam as a war. And after the trip, I saw it as a beautiful country full of these funny and engaging and loving people.
Who have a similar history of suffering as you.
Yes. Well, their suffering was even greater than mine in so many ways because it was their country that was destroyed.
Yeah.
It was their homes. When my father died, our country as a whole didn't really stand with families like ours during that time period. But my mother did get a widow's pension. That was not something Peter's mother got. They were looked upon with disgrace. You learn to have the perspective of another person's experience. Hmm. So when I hear people talk about laying down their lives, I think today we can't comprehend it in so many ways because we have become acculturated to individual rights without thinking about common good. there's very little talk about doing what's best for the other person. Mm. Me putting your needs ahead of my individual rights. My ability to see your suffering is eclipsed by my screaming, I have a right to do this.
Yeah. Yeah, we seem to be entitled to say whatever we want to in whatever tone we want. And we also, at the same time, seem to be claiming a right to never be offended. So we have a sickness in our country, but think about the family, too. When you talk about identifying with those who fell on the same field of battle as your father did, it seems to me that within the church family that we have our own kind of civil war going on here. Is it going to be civil or uncivil in the future? What kind of people are we going to be? What are we really called to do? And have we lived up to the highest ideals we say we've been given and the power that's been given us to live that way by the Holy Spirit? Or have we failed? And how is that going to affect the family going forward? Are we in a civil war within the body of Christ here, especially in America? Or is there something else going on?
Well, I think for the most part, people are being exploited. Just as we now know that the soldiers from the war in Vietnam were exploited for personal political gain. I mean, if I heard it once growing up, I heard it a gazillion times. When people would find out that my father died in Vietnam, they would say, what a waste. Mm. Can you imagine what that feels like to be the child of a fallen soldier and to be told over and over again from the time you're 9 years old that your dad wasted his life? That was something that I had to learn to come to grips with and to reclaim and to reform the narrative around, which I did do. Look, my father honored his country by doing what his country asked him to do. Now, did the country that was asking him ask him to do the right thing? No, they didn't. They did not put his welfare, the welfare of our family, or even the welfare of what was best for this nation first. They put their own interests first. And I see that happening today. The people have to rise up together as a family, as a nation, and say, I'm going to reclaim the narrative here. This is not the country I want to be. This is not the people I want to be. This is not the kind of believer I want to be. I think part of reclaiming that narrative is to reclaim treating people with dignity.
On the political and public level you're describing here, Karen, civility is something that is pretty easy to define. We need to change our narrative about others so that we're not othering constantly. It has practical implications. My bigger question is for the family of God, no matter what the administration might be around us, we still seem to have our own internal struggle going on. I'm not just talking about between denominations, but about those who are committed to a gospel life, a redemptive worldview that says God is working out his plan and loves people, and he's working it out through people that he calls to follow him to love others as he would, to be his hands and feet. That seems to be the prime ethic for those who are convinced of how Jesus lived, that we can do the same thing we're called to. And those who say, no, it's about identity and being not them. And that struggle seems to be raging right now within our own camp. I want to live myself evangelically, having a great story, to be an evangel, to be able to give account for this great good news that's living in me in my generation that was handed to me by godly people before me. I don't want to be stuck in a nationalistic or vindictive kind of pseudo-faith. That's my passion, and it sounds like it's yours too. At the same time, I'm not trying to set myself up in opposition to anybody within my own family. I don't want to be alienating people that don't vote or don't act or don't talk like me. I want to know all the people that God has in his family and to love them as much as I love those who are not being loved by anybody. What's our way through this right now? And do you see there being a big problem within the family of God?
I definitely see it as being a big family within the church and without the church. Because we are within the faith community, we should have a different perspective. This notion that we should all think the same and act the same, to me, sounds like people who want to live in North Korea. I don't want to be in a community of people who dress alike, look alike, think alike, act alike. I love the variety that comes with embracing the other and learning and growing. For me, it all goes back to that day on the porch. Hmm. Are you going to live out a life of being afraid of everything? Are you actually going to live out a life of faith? Hmm. A life of faith calls us to open up the gates, put the fences aside, and to just throw open the doors and say, all are welcome here. All are welcome here. No qualifiers. Hmm. Everyone is welcome here.
I'll get back to my special interview with Karen Zacharias in just a moment. But first, a quick reminder that it's your generosity and support that make Compassion Radio possible. Especially at a year like this, we need your vote of support. Call 1-800-868-2478. Write us at Compassion Radio, Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859, or give online at CompassionRadio.com in order to keep this program coming to you each day. We have a very special thank you for your generous support to keep this ministry on the air. It's a fresh take on that amazing story of the life of Jesus, written by the Apostle John. We're calling it the Dynamic Gospel, and I'd love to send you one if you ask for it. Just let us know when you contact us today with your gift.
When we truly understand what redemption means in our own lives and the potential for what it means in the lives of others, we do not live in fear. There is no us and them rhetoric.
Yeah.
It used to humor me when I would, you know, and I'm sure you've met these people too. It's all an us and them rhetoric, mm-hmm. and the world's going to hell in a handbasket, and we're so much worse of a people. I was having a discussion with someone this week about that, and I said, well, we're not throwing babies in the fire like they did in the Middle Ages, you know.
Yeah.
We have grown a little bit. Give us some credit.
You hope.
Yeah, I don't look at the world that way. To me, one of the characteristics of God, which is what I go back to time and time again, the character of God. What about the character of God? Who is God, and how well do we know that character? But one of the characters of God that I appreciate most is his beauty.
Hmm.
And when I focus on the beauty as a character of God, and I see it reflected in the world around me in that Wordsworth kind of fashion, and I understand that he is a master creator. I love the Native American reference to God as creator.
Mm-hmm.
And when we understand that we have two choices, we can live a life in existence of co-creating with God, or we can live a life of chaos in destroying what God creates.
Yeah.
Those are the only two options we have. And when we step into that community of, I want to co-create with you, then we stop destroying. Then we stop othering. And then we stop deriding and this divisiveness. And we seek the redemption in our own lives and redemption in the lives of those around us.
Hmm. I know this is kind of jumping way outside the conversation here, but this reminds me of a story I learned while walking in the Kyiv, Ukraine. And I visited with the pastors there that were in the Maidan during the uprising that brought down the crony government that mm-hmm. Russia was controlling. And they set up their prayer tent on a map that was made of brick in the middle of the plaza. All the other pavers around that tent had been ripped up and used as weapons to try to fight back against the tanks and the guns that were coming down upon the people. And those bricks were thrown. And the only bricks that remained locked on that ground was underneath that prayer tent. They literally held the ground down.
And when they lifted it up, they saw an outline of a section of Ukraine that within months became the next battleground, the eastern part of Luhansk and other parts of Donetsk next to Russia. They knew at that time they were to pray over those parts of Ukraine because they had not been affected by this uprising, but that there was going to be an attack coming. So they prayed from that day forward about what would happen there. And sure enough, civil war broke out in the east part of the country. But the other thing they did is they helped all the people after the uprising to take all those stones back and rebuild the plaza. So the people of prayer, the ones that asked God to show them what they needed to know for their country's sake, discovers a lot of hidden messages in the very world around them because they were looking, because they were praying, because they were expecting God to do something transforming and to help them rebirth their country. And I was fascinated by the color of those stones up against the new stones that were laid around it, and the work that the Christians together, of all denominations who had never worked together, did on their hands and knees to repave that part of the central plaza of the country. And I thought, man, I would love to see that kind of spirit happen here.
And, you know, we did see some of that spirit in the wake of Katrina in New Orleans.
That's true.
I had spoken to the families of the military at Fort Jackson about 3 months prior to Katrina hitting. And one of the officers had taken me on a tour. She was National Guard. And at that time, Louisiana had the highest deployment of National Guard units in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah, I remember that.
She was a young mom of 3 kids, and she was telling me about the levee and saying, I don't know what we would do if the levee broke because we don't have enough National Guard here to respond because so many are deployed. And I remember thinking at the time, what a weird thought for her to be worried about that, you know? And then 3 months later, Katrina hits, and then Fort Jackson folks invited me back a few months after Katrina to see the damage that had been done at the base. I mean, it was the Ninth Ward, all of that. I toured it with another officer from who had been at war in Afghanistan. He said the Ninth Ward looked worse than anything he had seen in Afghanistan. Yeah. It literally looked like the end of the world, but who was there? The churches from all over this nation brought their youth groups, brought their Bible study groups. They came, they rebuilt homes. They came and ministered. So the government wasn't showing up. It was the churches who were showing up. And they didn't say, what color are these people we're going to help? What faith are these people we're going to help? What denomination did they belong to? What political party did they belong to?
Yeah.
There was none of that. It was, let me grab my tool belt along with Jimmy Carter, and I'll be there rebuilding.
Yeah.
I even had a brother-in-law from Washington State who made the trip and lived down in the Gulf, helping for months on end. We have seen those, and we've seen it again in Texas, which I wrote about. You had people from other parts of the country coming in to raise funds, to be there to help those who've suffered so greatly during this unexpected freeze that has done so much damage.
The repercussions are pretty widespread. They're going to be a long time before we get recovered to our infrastructure where it needs to be.
And those who came in, we're not saying, well, what color are these people?
Yeah.
How much money do they make? What political party do they belong to? They were like, these are people in need. These are our brothers and sisters, and we need to go help the suffering.
Is it possible, Karen, for us in the slow-burning crisis we find ourselves, COVID, economics, you know, job loss, and political turmoil, is it possible for us within the church to be reminded that every crisis is really an opportunity for us to be at our best?
Yeah, I mean, we have to be willing to step into that. If we're afraid, if we're fearful that, oh, these people don't see the world the way I see it, or these people don't worship the God I worship, or these people aren't in my socioeconomic class, or these people don't do for themselves, whatever judgments we bring into that moment of othering, then no, we will never get there. But, you know, look, there are plenty of people inside and outside the church. There are plenty of people who are saying, I want to live a life of grace. I want to live a life of arms wide open. I want my life to represent the embodiment of mercy and kindness and all of those characters of Christ that we've read about, that we've known since preschool days. That's who I want to be. I want to treat people with dignity and kindness. And I may be a crippled woman and I may not be able to get my wheelchair to the church doors, but I'm going to sit here with my Bible open and I'm going to treat everybody I come in contact with through my day with dignity and kindness. That's how Jesus would do it, and that's what I'm going to do because he set the example.
Well, Karen, that's a very gentle way of saying it, and it sounds kind, but you've also thrown down the gauntlet in a big way to make us face up to our shortcomings in our own feelings. If we're surrounded so much by our own fears, of course, we're not going to see the needs of others. So I am praying that God breaks through the fear culture, and that we stop worrying about how we're feeling or what others might be doing to us or imagining the sins of others, and get on with just listening for what God wants to tell us. Ask him first, what do you want me to know, not to what I think is going on, and then let him guide our next steps. And especially at a time when we all have needs. We're all not really sure how it's going to play out, how COVID's going to end, how the economy's going to rebound, what's going to happen when we try to get our kids back to school, all those kind of things. But it starts now in our hearts to prepare for the future that God really does have for us. And I thank you for your gentle reminders of that, for being a gold star daughter that you are, and in very small and subtle ways, referencing that in your story in the past couple of days. Thank you for sharing that story with us. Can I also bring people's attention to your work online so they can find out more about your books?
Sure. They can find me at KarenZach.com, where I blog, and all of my books are on Amazon or through your local indie bookstore. I wrote about my father's death in a memoir that HarperCollins published called After the Flag Has Been Folded. And, you know, my novels deal, like I said, with community. But I'll leave you with this. When I was at that crisis of wanting to choose an open life versus a fearful life, the verse that I claimed as mine was, "For God has not given us the spirit of fear, but of love, of power, and of sound mind.
Yeah. Oh, that we would have more sound minds.
Sound mind. I mean, I have prayed so often. I don't want to give the impression that I don't get afraid. Of course, I do have children. I dealt with a bout of COVID myself. There are times when I am fearful, but I go back. And when I need a mantra, I don't look for a political slogan. I go back to, "For God has not given me the spirit of fear, but of love, of power, and of sound mind."
That's a great last word, Karen. Karen Zacharias, author, journalist, Gold Star daughter, and one of those Christian moms that we really need to be reminded of. You're out there. You are the kind of people that we need to be emulating and living a life and following your example, reminding ourselves of our better angels. God does want us to be the compassionate ones. In fact, it's the only thing he's called us to do. If he had no reason for us to be here, to be compassionate, he probably would have taken us home a long time ago. He's got work for us to do. It's the kind of work that he does from his heart, not to define ourselves against others, but to find ourselves with those who thought they were not loved by anybody. Thank you for your example and for your story.
Thank you, Brom. It's been great to be able to revisit this and to remind myself of the call upon my own life.
Very good.
It's rare to get the interview with a believer who isn't seeking to divide himself, you know. But unfortunately, where our country has been.
Indeed. Yeah. And I've asked the Lord many times in the past 4 years or so that I've been sitting in this chair, and I'm trusting that God has a plan for us in the future and to live past this chapter.
I appreciate your perspective on that. I used to say, you know, when people would say how bad things were, I would say, did you live through the 60s? You know, yeah. but this has topped that. I no longer say that. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
My thanks to Karen Zacharias, a Gold Star daughter, a great author, and more importantly, a real lover of Jesus. On our Monday broadcast, we've been highlighting the book of John and our special edition of that dynamic gospel. It's our special thank you for your support of Compassion Radio in this critically important time. I'd love to send you a copy. Just let us know you'd like one when you give today. Please call us today to let us know you're standing with us. The number is 1-800-868-2478. That's 1-800-868-2478. Our mailing address is Compassion Radio, P.O. Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. Again, Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. Of course, you can reach us 24/7 at CompassionRadio.com. There you'll find more information about the projects we do, the places we go, and the ways you can get involved today. That's CompassionRadio.com. Remember, if you missed any of today's interview or would like to share it with a friend, just head over to CompassionRadio.com and click the broadcast link in the menu. We'll see you tomorrow.